We're just, last week we started this, it's called Can a Scientist Believe in God? And these slides are crafted by Radhe Shyam, who's the president of our Pune temple in Maharashtra. And they're under the auspices of VOICE, which is an acronym for Vedic Oasis for Inspiration, Culture, and Education. So I can't claim that these slides originate here in Spanish Fork, Utah. But if it's a good thing, then use it for doing good. So these are the last few slides that we talked about last week. This is entitled, Who is in Control? And there's a lot of money and resources and talent being put into the area of artificial intelligence, especially at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Scientists are trying to develop supercomputers, but the most sophisticated computer in the universe has already been invented. And, of course, we talked about what that was last week. It is called the human brain. It's the most sophisticated computer in the universe. And no scientist, I mean, it's like, as far as we know, in human history, there's been a human brain. Even before anyone even heard of computers, there was human brains millions and millions and millions of years ago. In fact, it was that human brain that recorded history so that we even have a sense of history. And yet, that's the most sophisticated computer in the universe. The brain can store more information than all the libraries in the world. The brain is made of 1 trillion brain cells. Each one of those 1 trillion brain cells is more powerful and sophisticated. This isn't the brain. This is each one of those trillion brain cells is more powerful than the most sophisticated computers around the planet today. So who made the natural intelligence of this incredibly complex computer? If we get a great brainy scientist who wins a Nobel Prize, it never occurs to anyone to recognize or give credit to the person that gave the brain to the scientist. You know, we laud and honor the scientist, but it never occurs to anyone to praise the person who gave the scientist his brain, which he used for. And then again, discovery. What does discovery mean? It means that it was already there. The scientist just discovered it, that's all. You know, if it's one thing to discover gold, it's one thing to go out in them bar hills, you know, and discover gold, and that's one thing. But then you can't claim that you made the gold. You're just discovering something valuable that was already put. But they give all the credit and they give all the money and the resources to the person that discovered it. But actually, all he did was discover something that was incredibly valuable that was already there, put there by someone much, much greater than he. So here's where we actually left off last week and where we start today. Likewise, we see wonderful things created by man. And what are some of those wonderful things? Here's a nice, sleek car from Detroit. You see a car coming down the road. You say, well, what company made it? Was it GM or Chrysler or Ford? No, nobody made this car. It just appeared one day, you know. It was like an explosion in a junkyard, and it just sort of appeared. You know, you have that game when you're going down the freeway and you're kids, and you identify the manufacturers of the cars, Ford, GM, Chrysler, Jeep, and Willys, and all like that. But computer, trendy computer, that someone assembled it, Steve Jobs conceived it, and his crew in Carpinteria designed it and put it together, and then someone assembled it, and then someone marketed it, and someone shipped it, and of course, what would all that be worth if someone didn't use it? You know, I was thinking computers. You know, you spend like maybe $1,200 for a computer, but just think of how much it saves you. Also, for placing ads for our festivals in the old days, when I wanted to place an ad in the City Weekly, in the Salt Lake Tribune, and the Catalyst. I would have to get in the car, drive to Salt Lake City with my zip drive, go to each and every place, go back to the art department, wait while they transferred it, then I'd go to the next place and the next place. It was like a half a day just to place 3 or 4 ads. Now I just send them off by email and they're automatically there. It's just one of the examples of how life has become made easier and cheaper because of the computer. A lot less gas and resources and pollution was created because of the computer. And yet we never would imagine the computer just appeared by accident, nor would we this watch, you know. What's a sign of a really good watch? What's a sign of a really good watch? Is a sign of a really good watch it just appeared? Or what do you really say when there's a really good watch, a really well-crafted watch? Swiss, right? Isn't it? Swiss watch. Now if we see a good-looking watch on someone's hand, we might say, well, was it made in Switzerland? We don't just say, did it happen by accident? Someone designed it. The Eiffel Tower is an architectural marvel, also designed. What was the name of the guy? Eiffel. He was the guy, skyscraper building. Someone built it. We would never imagine in a million years. I think we talked yesterday about how, as a result of an explosion, nothing ever went from a lower level of organization to a higher level of organization. They say the universe started with a big bang. Well, how could that be true? Because every time there's an explosion, things go from a higher level organization to a lower level organization. Never in the history of the world, never in anyone's experience, as a result of an explosion or anything random, has something gone from a lower level of organization to a higher level of organization. And yet, every day, every moment, every hour, every minute, we have example of something that went from a lower level of organization or even disorganization to higher because of a person. This computer, this harmonium, and the book and all. We all know that those were organized in the way that they're organized because of people involved. People involved. What to speak of an explosion? If you just leave things alone, they will degrade. If we walk out of this room, close the doors, and don't come in for about 6 months, there will be dust and dirt everywhere. So everything sort of degrades by the course of nature. The example is time's arrow. You shoot an arrow, and it has an initial force which enables it to even arc or plateau. But sooner or later, it's just by its very nature and by the friction of the atmosphere, just gets lower and lower and lower and lower and lower. So left on their own, things just degrade. It takes a human hand or a personal hand to revive things and to organize them, as we see in all of these different examples here. Any creation implies a creator. That's what the word creation means. That's what the word creation means. If you have an explosion, you don't describe the results of the explosion as a creation. You don't describe that as a creation. You describe that as a destruction. You can take a beautiful creation and explode it, and the result is not another creation. The result is a destruction. The end of that. Whatever is pleasing to the eye, or whatever beautiful lines it has, or whatever elegance, or whatever colors it has, or texture, that's all destroyed as a result of an explosion. You don't get a creation as a result of an explosion. So, question that has to come up in the mind of any reasonably intelligent person is, shouldn't this universe have a super intelligent creator? I talked to two people on the phone today. Who was it? Oh yeah, two people. Mona, who's doing our PowerPoints and all. She says her husband's hero is, what's his name, Richard Dawkins. And he calls all this religious stuff rubbish, right? Like that. He calls all this religious stuff rubbish. And then Kristen, who called, was interested in the training. You know, we talked about her this morning. She lives in Connecticut. And she also has an entire aunts, uncles, and everyone who are all atheists like that. So two people I talked to today that are just right up against this, you know, disbelief. It all happened by accident. There's no meaning. There's no rhyme and reason. But if there's no God, if there's no creator, there's no purpose in life. If there's no creator, then there's no purpose, you see. This microphone was created for a purpose. This computer was created for a purpose. If we are created not by any creator, but by accident or by random, then there is no purpose. You just live your life, you breathe, you take up space, you use oxygen, and then you die. And there's really no purpose, there's really no reason to get out of bed in the morning. If there's no creator, there's no purpose in the creation. So shouldn't this universe have an intelligent creator? Now, what do the scientists, generally the scientists themselves, now there's scientists and scientists. Prabhupada says in the Bhagavad Gita that the real scientists are those that believe in God. The pseudoscientists are those that don't. So what do the scientists feel? Let's poll the scientists and see what they feel or what they think about a supreme intelligent designer. Here's Albert Einstein. There is a perfect brain behind all the natural physical laws. Lord Kelvin, if you think strongly enough, you will be forced by science to believe in God. Wherever you see order, then you're forced to think of an ordainer. Unless you're just really stubborn. You've got this prejudice, you've got this bias. You know, how can you see order and not see an ordainer unless you've already decided that you just won't do that? You've just already decided that you won't do that. You've made a conscious decision. I won't do that. Otherwise, how can you see order with even a halfway open mind and not see an ordainer? How can you see a creation without seeing a creator? Newton, the most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets, could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. You know, we told that story about how Newton assembled a little model of the universe in his apartment, and he invited his atheistic friend over, and the first words the atheistic friend said when he came, "Oh, what a beautiful model of the universe. Who made it?" And Newton said, "Oh, nobody made it. I just like you, I just came in my apartment half an hour ago, and it was just here." And the guy said, "Oh, you're crazy. You're full of it. You know, someone had to have made it." And then Newton said, "This is just a little fake imitation toy model of the universe, and you insist that someone had to have made it, and then you turn around and say the universe itself, the real thing, of which this is just a shadow little puny model, was created by accident and no one created it." And the atheist said, "You may have a point. You may have a point." And again, Newton says, "This being governs all things, not as the soul of the world, but as Lord over all. And on account of his dominion, he is to be called Lord God, universal ruler." That's the basic problem in modern society. If there is a God, and of course there is, then he's the Lord and we're the servants. Unfortunately, even those people who are religious, who do acknowledge the existence of a God, view him as someone to carry out their desires. They see him as the servant and ourselves as the Lord. So if we do go to the church or the temple or the mosque, we go with our shopping list, you know, our little Christmas list, and we pray, "Help my son pass his grades in school. Help my blood test be negative for cancer. Help me get a raise in my position job, or help me not to lose my job, blah, 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 blah." So we want to make God our servant. But in fact, if he created the universe, then he created us and the universe for a certain purpose, and we should rather inquire what are his purposes rather than our purposes. Otherwise, it's aberrant. Look at the ground reality. Glamorous. Not so glamorous. And we're seeing differences. We're seeing differences. If everything just appeared for the first time as a material manifestation and there was no cause, there was no background, if everything was simply effect without cause, then why the differences? Why the differences in bodily beauty? Why the differences in IQ? Why the differences in economic status? Why the differences in ethnic? Why all these differences? You know, if things are made mechanically in Detroit on the assembly line, every car comes out exactly the same. And yet we find that just the opposite is true in the creation. No two people are exactly the same. No two people are exactly the same. What to speak of people, there are 60,000 species of beetles. Why would there be, what is the need, what is the necessity for 60,000 species of beetles? From any sort of pragmatical, functional point of view, why do you need 60,000 species? Wouldn't 20,000 be okay, or even 1,000, or couldn't we get by with 100? You know, why? Because the Creator is an artist, and he loves variety. He loves to create things in multi-variety. Within a cubic feet of snow, there are 13 million snowflakes. 13 million snowflakes within a cubic feet, and no two snowflakes are exactly the same. So you'll search in vain amongst all living beings to find two entities, two souls that are carbon copies of each other. God just doesn't do that. God doesn't do that. You know, you'd think he's creating trillions and trillions of living beings who populate all the planets and all the universes. You'd think, you know, if there's a living being here on Earth and there's another living being on Mercury or Mars, I mean, they're never going to meet. Who's going to know? You know, save a little time, cut a corner, make a couple carbon copies. He doesn't do that. No two living beings are the same. And the reason is, the reason that out of His infinite personality He makes each one of us unique and distinct is because He wants to enjoy what we call rasa. Rasa is a Sanskrit word which you can't exactly translate, but the closest is a certain mellow or a certain taste. He wants to enjoy a different taste of love from each and every one of His creations. So we're all made in different flavors. Talk about Baskin-Robbins, 57 flavors. God has made in 57 gazillion flavors. And He wants to engage in loving affairs and pastimes with each and every one of us. And each and every one of us has something unique to give to God. See, the pleasure of love, of loving His devotees and being loved in return, is greater than the inherent pleasure of being God. See what I'm saying? Obviously, there are inherent benefits to being God. You're all powerful. You know everything. You're self-sufficient, and so on and so forth. And those are certainly significant benefits. But the benefit of loving you and you and you individually and uniquely and distinctly enhances God's inherent qualities, and it actually yields Him greater pleasure to engage in loving back and forth reciprocal affairs than it does just being God. I mean, after all, what's the fun in just being? You know, okay, let's just all spend the evening here just being. You be, I'll be. I mean, whatever you are, even if you're God, I mean, it's like, there's not much fun in just being, you know? Is there? We had a visit from someone, and she came with her parents and all. She kind of likes to do all this pseudo-spiritual philosophy and all like that. And so we were sitting downstairs with her mother and father. Both are highly intellectual people. They teach at BYU. And the fiancé and my wife and I were having this wonderful theological discussion, all like that. And she says, well, I think we should just be. And everyone sort of said, okay, I guess that's the end of that discussion. You know, it's like, who broke wind here? You know what I'm saying? I mean, that was a brilliant contribution, you know, onward and upward, like that, you know. So God loves to create an infinite, unlimited variety, and that's why we find that everything doesn't just come out carbon copy. Everything and everyone is different. Some are handsome, some are not so handsome. Can I see them again? Some are fabulously rich. Some are poverty-stricken. One man gets a medical education, becomes an MD, a doctor. Another lifts heavy weights and spends his entire life as a coolie. Why are these differences? One child is born with a silver spoon and has a nice car ride right from childhood. Another child is born to parents who have no money to move out of their poverty-stricken single-room shack. So who decides? Any alleviation of suffering that we've experienced in human history has been by applying the law of cause and effect. You know, yellow fever. What caused yellow fever? There were so many things that were looked at, and there were so many experiments that were done, and finally they found it's a certain mosquito. And then once they discovered that this mosquito causes yellow fever, they created something to exterminate the mosquito. Now there's no yellow fever anywhere. Same thing for scarlet fever, same thing for polio. If you have an unwanted effect, then you can remove the unwanted effect by identifying and eliminating the cause. So who decides? Who decides? Who enjoys and who suffers? What is the principle at work here? There's obviously a law in effect, and whatever there's a law, there must be what? A lawgiver. There must be a lawgiver. We choose a job. These are the things that are within our control. Because we're creating the image of God, so we have a little wiggle room there. We have a little control, but He's unlimited, He's infinite, and we're infinitesimal. Just like we were talking last week, we put up our little Sputnik, you know, we put our Sputnik in the sky, and He puts up planets, you see. We have a little creative power to put our Sputnik up, and that creative power comes from God, but His creative power is so much greater. He puts up planets, big Sputnik planets. You see what I'm saying? So we also have independence, and we have certain things that we can choose. We can choose a job. We can choose a wife and a husband. We can choose the type of car we drive. We can choose an apartment, and we can choose a lot more things. But there are things that we don't choose. And these are actually the big, big things. And we don't get a say in those things. We can't choose our parents. We can't choose our beauty or lack of it. We can't choose our intelligence or lack of it. Who chooses? Who decides that this soul goes here and this soul goes there and this soul goes there and this, that you're born on this street in this country of these parents and in this economic situation? And what's the basis for the choice? What is the basis? Who chooses? Is it random? Is it like throwing darts at a board? Or is the reason that the higher power chooses that we all find ourselves in different births and different circumstances? Here it's asked the question, is it just by chance? Is it just a flip of the coin that you were born Proud Luck and I was born Warden and you were born Evans? Is it just by chance? And at the same time, it's hard to believe this by chance, because everywhere we look, we see order and systematic arrangement in the universe. We see atomic structures. We see solar systems. We see DNA. We see incredibly complex chains of RNA, FCC, BCC structure. If we look at the dictionary meaning, in the Oxford Dictionary meaning of the word cosmos, the definition of it is an orderly and harmonious systematic universe. It's mentioned here that the bond angle, here let me get this note that I have here, the molecular bond angle slightly changes. For instance, in an individual molecule, you have certain electrons and protons and neutrons and all like that. And if you just change a slight molecule, just a little iota, it changes the entire characteristic of the molecule. The difference between an aromatic scent and a pungent scent is just a little tiny juxtaposition of an electron. That's all it is. And yet the difference is huge in terms of effect and in terms of fragrance. So where are these structures coming from? It took a team of 21 scientists, 8 years, working around the clock, to draw a picture of the vitamin B12 molecule. And they got the Nobel Prize for it. All they did was, they just drew a picture of a vitamin B12 molecule and they got the Nobel Prize for it. But who made the vitamin B12 molecule? And who made it in such a way that if you just alter one little bit of the structure, it becomes something? The characteristics, the property of it, come differently. In the universe here, I think that one with the around it is Pluto. So the planets, they orbit at huge speeds. I mean, look at our freeway. People go, they're going 75, 80 miles an hour, and every day there's accidents. And there's all these safety features, and there's only two lanes, and there's only two ways to go. It's relatively safe, and still people find ways to create fatalities. Imagine the universe where there's all kinds of planets. They're going at, they're huge destructive bodies. I mean, if you think having a head-on collision with a Cadillac could be ruin your day, how about if two planets hit each other? And yet it never happens. They're traveling different directions, different speeds, and they never hit. And it's interesting because the orbits are all different. They're not all concentric. If they were all orbiting this way, then there wouldn't be any danger. But they're going this way and this way and this way and this way and this way. And some of them are going elliptical and some of them are a little shallow orbit. And yet they're all arranged and organized in such a way they don't hit each other. And someone says, this is by accident and there's no God in control. I mean, hello, hello. And the orbit of Pluto is interesting because the orbit of Pluto is very elliptical. It's almost flat. It's elliptical, and it goes between two other planets. There's two other planets that are going, and Pluto, like, what do they call it when a surfing term, you ride the pipe or shoot the gap or shoot the... Pluto just slips in, like since millions and millions of years, Pluto has just slipped in. I mean, it is precise timing, exactly precise timing. And what to speak of our planet being hit, if any of those planets, Mercury, if any of them had a collision, it would... I mean, that would be pretty much it for everything else. So there's amazing order. Amazing order. Another example is at an intersection, a busy intersection, and we have to take the intersections in America as an example, not the intersections in India. Someone said that the material world is a perverted reflection of the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, you have grass, you have trees, you have rivers, and you have clouds and peacocks and parrots and all kinds. All that exists in the spiritual world. And that's the real world. That's the substantial world. The only difference is that in the spiritual world, everything's eternal. There's no matter. If you're a peacock, you have a spiritual body and you're eternal. If you're a blade of grass, you're eternally so. And you're conscious. The trees, for instance, in the spiritual world can give you anything you want because they're conscious living beings. So you ask the tree, I want a drum to play for Krishna, or I want a harmonium, or I want some powdered milk to make some sweets. The tree can actually give it to you because the tree is a conscious living being. Just like you're a conscious living being, so you can fetch any number of things from the store that I ask for. In this material world, a pear tree can only give pears, an apple tree can only give apples, and so on and so forth. But in the spiritual world, anything can give anything. And that's the real world, and that's eternal. And then this material world is a reflection of the spiritual world. Well, someone took that a step further as a joke and said, India is a reflection of the material world. So when we make our case for order, we cite an American intersection and not an Indian intersection. So who keeps the traffic from, you know, running into each other and so on and so forth? These huge, huge planets, which weigh millions and millions of tons. And that's another thing. Like, how does a planet float? How does a planet float? I mean, I can just take a fiber from this carpet and it's weightless, and I'll drop it and it'll just... I mean, a feather, you see. It'll... Cotton. And planets weigh millions and they're floating. What's that all about? By whose power? Who has entered into them and caused them to float in thin air? Now, I'll just make one or two more points and then it'll be time for the yoga class here. I see you all come for that and brought your mat. So tremendous energy, another consideration, is the energy that's emitted by the sun. The energy that's emitted by the sun in 1 second is greater than the amount of energy the human species has consumed throughout its entire history. Behind the tremendous energy, there must be an energetic person who is the possessor of all energies. Energy runs our lights here, the chandeliers. Energy runs all this. And yet, it doesn't happen impersonally. We can trace it back to the powerhouse, which was built by an architect, which is maintained by a tradesman, and it was designed by someone. And so, always, wherever there's energy, you can always trace it back to an energetic source, and that energetic source is always personal. There are all kinds of atheistic explanations for why the sun shines. Well, they used to believe, well, it's a big lump of coal, you know, and it's burning. But then, after a few thousand years, they said, well, how come it's not getting smaller? Because coal, you know, as it emits kinetic energy, it gets smaller and smaller, and yet the sun hasn't diminished in size in known history. So much for that. And then it was nuclear explosions. It's all these kinds of nuclear explosions on the surface of the sun. And yet the sun constantly emits energy without diminishing in size. And we don't have a precedent for that in material world. If you have a log and you burn it, the log gradually disappears. And it becomes gas and heat and so on and so forth. So the Vedic explanation for the sun is that it is an incarnation of God. God is that person who can emit unlimited energy and not be reduced. That's one of the aspects of the absolute truth. For us, 1 minus 1 leaves 0. On the absolute platform, 1 minus 1 still leaves 1. God creates infinite universes with infinite populations and infinite suns, and it doesn't affect him. He's not lessened in any way by these magnificent acts of creation. So he creates the universe, and he expands himself as what's called Surya Narayan. And in order that the solar system be maintained, he expands himself, and the sun itself is a manifestation of unlimited energy. Unlimited energy. An expansion of the Lord. The cost of lighting a stadium for one whole night during a cricket match is several lakhs of rupees. Now consider lighting an entire state or country for 1 week or month. This can give us an idea of how much we would have to spend if there were no sun. So, it's time for yoga. This has been part two of a series originally power-pointed by Radhesham Kune called Can a Scientist Believe in God? And we've already seen tonight how many of the most prominent scientists do indeed believe in God. And we'll continue next week talking on the subject of organization and craftsmanship.